I Am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more lively and thoughtful books you'll get is the recent publication, 149 Paintings You Really Need to See in North America So You Can Ignore the Others. It's written by two prominent lawyers in Toronto who are lifelong art lovers. What Julian Porter and Stephen Grant have done is written a guidebook listing paintings that can be seen in public art galleries throughout the United States and Canada that reflect the work of the greatest painters in history, from Picasso to Matisse, Modigliani to Renoir, Emily Carr to Tom Thompson, Cezanne to Gauguin. This book has those paintings that are necessary to see. They're listed geographically, so if you find yourself in Boston or Philadelphia or New York City, as I'll be shortly, you can go to the appropriate galleries and, as the subtitle says, seek the important works and skip the rest. Each listed painting is usually accompanied by a photo in the book, and all the paintings have an essay written by Mr. Porter or Mr. Grant. Stephen Grant joins me now. I'll ask him about his appreciation of 20th century modernists, as well as how he views the work we see in this book. I'll get him to tell us why he's written this book and why, with Mr. Porter, who worked as a student tour guide in Europe and North America before his career as a litigation lawyer. Stephen Grant is a family lawyer in Toronto, where I've reached him this morning. He brought his many years of experience in family law to the firm he launched in 2017, Grant Crawford Watson. He was awarded the Law Society Medal in 2006, the Advocate Society Medal in 2017, and most recently, the 2017 OBA Award for Excellence in Family Law. This book is published by Dunder, and I hope to have Julian Porter on the show in the coming days. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Stephen Grant. Mr. Grant, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
So I've reached you in your office there in Toronto, is that right?
That's right.
I know it's a new firm, but I'm assuming that you've decorated it. Could you tell us sort of how you've decorated, what sort of pieces of art are up and about there?
It's actually a morphing of one firm that I started with my partner in 2012, I think, to taking on some partners. That's all. Well, yes, I have an acrylic type representation of Double Mint Gum in the reception area. Uh-huh. I've got a Mel Buckner blah 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 type piece in the reception as well. I have a neon sculpture also in the reception, and then a lot of it is decorated, at least in my own office, with what my wife calls early Canadiana.
Uh-huh.
So Goodrich Roberts and people like that, very serene landscapes, which is funny because my tastes run more to generally abstract art, but
yeah.
I happen to find these pieces, the landscapes, very soothing.
Yeah, there are, of course, 149 paintings in this book,
yeah.
And you and Mr. Porter alternate as to who does the essay, but there's a couple in there that you both write on. There's one in particular that I'll bring up later, but you write about Tom Thompson, both of you.
Yes.
And you talk about just what he means to this country, and I mean, it stirs deep feelings in both of you, doesn't it?
I'm shivering hearing you say that. He's such an iconic figure in Canadian art. Let me go back just contextually for you, if I may.
Yeah.
The part of the kind of demarcation came about because, to the extent I know anything about art, which is, I'm sure, debatable, I'll tell you a funny story in a moment, but Julian's knowledge is way more classical than mine. He gave tours to young college kids in, when he was a young lawyer and young lawyer, so his knowledge is profound. I'm relatively self-taught, but my knowledge and interest sort of goes from Matisse on to the moderns. That's kind of where my interests lie. And so what happened was Julian realized when he wanted to do North America that there's such a proliferation of abstract and modern art in the North American galleries that he needed a co-author, and that's how I got involved. But what I was going to tell you was... actually, I think I've forgotten what I was going to tell you, but for Tom Thompson,
yeah.
He is such a, partly because of the circumstances surrounding his death, his questionable, odd death, that he's just become such an iconic figure in the landscape of Canadian art, particularly involved in landscape painting of Northern Ontario, which was seen in the early 20th century to be very representative of what Canadian art was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so both of you felt very strongly about him, and I mean, in the book, I mean, speaking of this coast where I'm talking from today in Vancouver, Emily Carr, I guess, represents sort of what BC, I mean, her work does that, doesn't it?
It does do that for sure.
Yeah.
In the same way that Lauren Harris also represents a landscape vision of more, perhaps, of eastern Canada, but certainly Canada generally. That those painters, the group of seven, Ann Thompson, Carr, and like, just showed what an incredibly diverse and spectacular country we live in, and they're well worth keeping on hand and in mind just for that fact.
So you mentioned the taste that both you and Julian Porter have and how they differ. When you see the classics, the ones that Julian writes about in the book so effusively, so passionately, how do you react?
As he would say, I think about me very kindly. I have learned so much about art by reading Julian, trying to see the paintings with that passionate eye that he's got, and learning more about things that I actually was never learned or was never taught for no apparent reason except lack of pursuit. And I see, especially Rembrandt, his favorite Rembrandts. I see the brilliance of his eye working and his mind taking in and really appreciating what he's seeing. We were on a TV show which was taped not too long ago. He was talking about Rembrandt. I said to him, "Well, actually, I think, aren't you a contemporary of Rembrandt?" So.
but he does say at the end of the book that you sort of jolted his eyes into looking art in a new way.
And in fact, being with him over these last couple of years, we've given tours together as well, art and gallery tours for various reasons.
Yeah.
But I learned a lot seeing the art from the way he sees the art. And I tried, in fact, to convey that in what I wanted people to, anybody who are readers, anybody who reads this book, to try to see what I'm seeing in a way. You're when you look at a piece of art, Joe, your eye and your brain tries to make sense. I'm looking at a landscape of actually modern landscape as we speak, and it's a dabbing of painting on this canvas that my eye wants to make sense of this in some way so that I see it more of what it is, which is a kind of lakeside landscape than just a collection of paint on the canvas.
And did you guys argue about art?
No, our periods were very different, so we didn't have occasion to argue. And as you say, there were a couple pieces that we both found compelling to write about, but because of the periods we look at and the way we look at art, I think he's more emotional, and I think I'm more cerebral when we look at art. But we've never really had any particular arguments about anything. We're on good terms still.
Yeah. So this you mentioned a moment ago, but just how edifying art can be for a person, and what it does for you when you look at a work, say.
Well, you used really what I think is the optimum word for that when you use the word edifying. Well, I'm sure you don't, but people mistake that for being educational. Whereas I think when you say edifying, I take the actual real meaning of it, which is spiritually uplifting, and that's what I find. I find art is spiritually uplifting. Apart from the interesting facet of that, technically, how do they do this? How do they put dabs of pigment on a canvas and make you say, well, I guess that's a landscape, or that's a cityscape, or that's a building, or that's a person?
Uh-huh.
The word edify is exactly the right word for that. It is, part is an enriching experience.
Yeah, so even when you look at a BRAC, for example, and it's complicated, it can be overwhelming for the eye, that gives you something, doesn't it? And I think you write this in the book, that it forces you to be introspective, not just about the piece of art itself, but your own life.
That's the beauty of it, for sure. It forces you to take stock, reimagine your images, rearrange them, rearrange your thoughts. It challenges you in many ways. The abs, Julie would say this, I think, very kindly, but trying to write about abstract art, which I thought would be a challenge for me, yeah, is hard. It's not, and there's, you know, words and, you know, decades of, especially in the 60s, of words spilled about writing about abstract art, which is hard, but it does force you to really try to make sense of what you're seeing and put perspective and context into it.
Yeah. What?
But BRAC is a good example.
Yeah. And so when you look at someone like BRAC, and you obviously have a demanding, busy job, have you always found art to be, say solace at the end of the day, or something that you can turn to when things get complicated?
Well, I think probably I'm probably really a bit of a dilettante, to be honest, but I've had various passions of various things over my life. I can tell you this, from the time I was young, from the time I grew up in the United States, but from the time I was young, there was something about art that just spoke to me. It just, I'm not quite sure I could articulate what it is, but something I found deeply, deeply, deeply enriching and moving and meaningful to me. I remember, for example, I didn't mention this in the book, but there was a completely cheesy, 1,000 print type lithograph or seriograph, whatever it was, of Place du Tertre in Paris, and there was something about the shade of blue that was in the center of this piece that I can conjure that up as we speak today. And I must have been, it was in my parents' my home at the time, and I still have it actually, but it must be, you know, it's, we're talking 50, 60 years ago that I first saw this thing, and it, as I say, it's a cheesy representation, but something about that was meaningful to me.
How did you guys pick 149 paintings? Because, I mean, each gallery, is, as you mentioned in the book, have, you know, hundreds, if not dozens of pieces. I guess when I read the book and I look through these paintings, I mean, these are fairly important artists, and they're important works, aren't they?
Well, I'll tell you how I did it. The 149 was a concept from Julian's first book, and I think it was really merely a conceit and a catchy thing to do. He picked 149 because that seemed like fun to do. I picked mine. What I was trying to do was take the artists that I think were important artists, generally speaking, but because I did pick some that I think are important but aren't so well known. So how I did it was I would pick the artist and the piece that I wanted to do, which wouldn't necessarily be the piece that everybody would think of about that artist. I wanted to pick a piece of art by an artist that wouldn't necessarily be the one that you would immediately know or would knock your socks off, but something that would be a little more challenging. Agnes Martin, for instance, Demon Korn in his Ocean Park series will have done, you know, I don't know how many, 30, 40 of that series, and they would have subtle shades of difference. So so picking one Demon Korn over another might not make a lot of difference, but I wanted to pick one that I thought would be appealing, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just thinking about
I hope I'm not rambling on.
No, absolutely not. No, the pieces in the book. These are paintings that you've obviously seen over the years, and they've evoked memories, emotions. When you're sitting writing the pieces for the book, your pieces in particular, does it take a long time? Because, I mean, you must have either a lot of feelings or not so
a lot
many.
Of time. Yeah. Either have a lot of feelings or a lot of time.
Yeah.
Do they take a long time? Some were, in fairness, easier to write than others.
Yeah.
Some were very, very challenging. Again, particularly if I'm writing about American Gothic, which I did, that's so immediate and so known and so arresting that's sort of easy. But the ones that are hard, for instance, I mentioned Agnes Martin a minute ago, or Demon Corn, they're harder to write about because of the abstraction and the abstract nature of the piece. They're harder to write.
You mentioned American Gothic, and I'm thinking of Nighthawks, and I'm thinking of Surratt's Sunday Afternoon.
Yes.
These three paintings in particular are ones that we've known over the years.
They're iconic pieces.
Yeah. And a lot of us know, say, the parodies of them or their depictions in popular culture more than the actual pieces.
Correct.
Why is it important that we actually see the real ones?
It gives you context and it gives a seriousness that the painter intended that we've now turned into mocking commercialism, which is fine. It's just, it is what it is. I was at a show last night, a rock concert that was kind of the Beatles revisited, and they were showing a commercial that I'd completely forgotten when I was a kid of Kellogg's Corn Flakes by those two people in American Gothic. I'd completely forgotten that until this thing showed up. But it's because it makes serious. I mean, Grant Wood wasn't thinking he was going to create this satirical piece. He meant that. He meant to show something about those stolid Midwesterners. Surratt, for sure, was not thinking that the people would mock it or would be turned into Sunday in the Park with George. Mm. I mean, so it's a matter of the seriousness with which the painter painted the painting. So you have to show what was at the root of the thing in the first place, and then you want to mock it or make fun of it or satirize it. Great, you know, good.
Yeah. So, the Mona Lisa, for example, that's not in the book, but you know, that's a painting that all of us have seen in other books, in on television. I'm thinking of Picasso, Braque, Chagall. What's it like then to see these things up close? I mean, that experience, is there any way you can describe that?
It's an amazing experience. But let me. It's funny you mentioned the Mona Lisa because Julian, in his first book, and I tease him about this. He left out the. If you look at the first one, he left out the Mona Lisa. Uh-huh. I said to him, "What was the problem with the Mona?" I said, "How could you actually leave out the Mona Lisa?" Bearing in mind, I left out a few that I might go back and do again, but never mind. He said, as far as he's concerned, the Mona Lisa is mud. Okay, he thinks it's mud. I just said, I'm not sure how you can leave that out of a book on European art, but there you go. But the difference is this. I first saw the Mona Lisa, 35 years ago, when you could walk right up to it. It didn't have plexiglass in front of it. It didn't have a room where there was probably 1,000 people in it with selfie sticks taking, you know, taking selfies of them and the Mona Lisa. And it's a hugely... A hugely, really moving experience to see these pieces in person and up close. It's really meaningful. Apart from anything else, I like getting close enough not to set the alarms off, but yeah. I like getting close enough so that I can try to understand how that painter did it, how that painter actually made, you know, a bunch of lines on a page look like an apple or whatever it is. You know, it's always fascinating to me how they do that.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, uh-huh. Seeing the real thing is the best thing.
Yeah. No. I think Julian mentions this in one of his pieces about taking his iPhone out and taking pictures. Do you do that when you're at a gallery? Say.
I try almost never to do that. I might buy a postcard, uh-huh. but I try never to do that if I can help it. Only because I want the experience. I want the personal experience. That's all.
Yeah, and another piece that both you and Julian write about is Klimt's Lady in Gold.
Yeah, we ended up going to the Neue Gallery at different times for various time. It is a truly spectacular painting. Have you been there? If you haven't.
No, I've seen the movie, though, like everybody else.
Yeah, the movie was great. That lawyer actually spoke to a group that we heard a while back. Very interesting. But that, when you get to New York next, you go go to that Noya, because you can walk right up to that Klimt, and there it is. It's glittering. I mean, uh-huh. Gold glitters, but it's incredibly beautiful, beautiful piece of art. Incredible.
And the food's good in the gallery, I understand.
The cafe is actually good with kind of Viennese, schnitzel and stuff like that. It's quite good.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. I'm going to New York shortly, and I hadn't thought about the Noya until I read this book.
Go to Noya. Do not miss Noya, and then go downstairs and have a soccer tort or something. But go to the Noya. You must not miss that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what I find fascinating in the essays that both of you write is how you put these works into context. Because as you say, they're not just pieces of art, paintings or colors put together. There is a context to them. There's the burden of, say, the artist's life, the times that they lived in which these pieces were composed. That's important for both of you, isn't it? When you look at the piece of art, to consider the person that makes it at the same time, right?
100%. You're looking at what factors, what environmental, what commercial, what natural factors are influencing that artist at the particular time. The Impressionists were as much influenced by their time and place and their habitat, if you will, or their environment as anything else. They were massively moved by how to reshape color based on landscape and texture that they were looking at day to day. Like Monet's Giverny is just all about textures and hues and his beautiful landscape in that garden he's got north of Paris, for sure.
Now, some of these artists, though, are unpleasant, and especially in this time that we're living in the Me Too movement, are you able to separate the artist from their art?
That's a tough question. I mean, that's going on now, and it's certainly a very heightened political, sexual harassment type context with movies and movie makers and actors and stuff. I don't have a good answer for that question. I try to take the piece of art and just see the piece of art for what it is in its time and place and how it's still meaningful after all these years. So I try to do that. It's not always possible, but you try to do that as best you can.
Yeah. The subtitle of the book says that these are paintings that we really need to see, and we can skip the others. I mean, you don't really mean that, do you?
It's cheeky. It came from Julian's first book, and it was really cheeky, and I thought it was fun. It was fun.
Yeah.
He actually means it more than I mean it. But,
so what?
That's the truth.
So when I go to the Frick or I go to the Met shortly, how much time should I spend? I mean, the book is wonderful in that I can ration my time, especially if I'm in a hurry. But
you should see the Frick is accessible, so you should see everything in the Frick that you can. Okay, mm-hmm. You should see everything. The Frick will take you, if it takes you half a day, that'd be a lot, but you should see everything in the Frick, which is very manageable. MoMA, did you say MoMA or the Met? MoMA, there are two or three floors that you will see in, again, two, half to three quarters of a day. I'll tell you a funny story about MoMA in a minute,
yeah.
But some of them you just can't, like the Met, you just couldn't do it. I remember reading a book years ago about how you could manage doing the Met. This guy had written a book about four or five days that you would spend in the Met, seeing this on this day and that on that day. Some of them are just impossible to do like that. But do not miss spending what you need to spend in the Frick, for
yeah.
sure. I'll tell you about MoMA. So I was in MoMA with my wife. This is two, 3 months ago. And we went through, you always go to the bookshop just if I buy a postcard or whatever. So I see the book. I see our book there.
Uh-huh.
I see the manager. I say, how's that book selling? He says, it's actually doing quite well. Why do you want to know? I said, because I'm one of the authors. He said, no way. I said, yeah, way. He said, well, okay, there's half a dozen copies over there. Go and sign them. So I'm sitting, I'm in MoMA bookshop signing those books, which was very cool.
Yeah.
It was a very cool experience.
Yeah, and I mean, to think that you can influence someone's view of art. I mean, I read the book, and I can see your taste, and I can see Julian's taste, and it may not be mine, but, I mean, I understood the piece of art better. And, I mean, to think that you're actually having that effect on, say, Well, museum goers, but people interested in art. I mean, that must be really fun.
It is really fun, and to the extent that I've influenced your taste by looking at what I've written one way or the other, for better or worse, you say, you know what, I hear what he's saying, as they say, but it doesn't speak to me. Okay, fair enough. And if I'm some other piece, you say, oh, my God, I had no idea about this piece. This is really beautiful or whatever it is. So I've influenced you that way. It's my dialogue with the art goer, with the sort of museum goer. It's my way of dialoguing. I had an imaginary reader out there who I was really trying to have a dialogue and show what spoke to me, and then maybe it'll speak to you.
Yeah. I mean, and it must be fun just sitting with Julian and talking about this stuff. I mean, I'd like to see that somehow, and I guess...
get us out to Vancouver, wherever you are out there.
Yeah, indeed. You mentioned the television program a moment ago that you both appeared on. Is that Pakin's thing?
Yeah. It hasn't shown yet.
No, I can't wait to see that, because, I mean, I'm sure, yeah, the conversation between the two of you, between
we
you and
we actually had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'll fun bet. Show. Yeah, I'll bet. This has been such a pleasure to talk to you. And as I said, I don't have a keen eye for art, but after reading this book, it's made me appreciate art a little bit better. And I think that's a credit to both you and Julian. I appreciate your time today, Stephen. Thanks for this.
Listen, I'm really glad to speak with you. I'm glad that it stimulated your interest. And if I can chat any further, or if you want to send me a note, happy to chat always.
I'll let you know how my visit to New York is,
yeah,
and how I
do.
Managed
I'm
to get
really
all
interested. Yep.
get all these museums in. You know,
you got to get them in. You just have to do it. Okay.
Absolutely.
Pull your cap down and head out there and do it.
The book is called 149 Paintings You Really Need to See in North America, so you can ignore the others. It's published by Dunder, and it's written by Julian Porter and Stephen Grant. Mr. Grant, join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.